On this open paddock number 189 for Monday, May 29th, 2013, Peter Dempsey wears his brown pants and wins his first Indy Lights race and the first win at IMS for Bilardi. Tony Kanaan finally breaks through to the other side, winning his first 500 after coming close so many times. Pikes Peak is just around the corner and STPR is this weekend and WRC goes to Greece. And Nico wins on his hometown streets. This is open paddock number 189. And I am your host, Kevin Neely, and we got a couple of people with us today. It's my homeboy, Douglas Patterson. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, sir. It's great to meet you at IMS, finally.
Yes, it was great to meet me as well.
Nice.
I'm sure your life is complete now. And
It is. That's one check mark I can make on my bucket list. So.
I hope that shrine to me you probably have in your house now is fine. I'll send you that autographed picture in the mail. Mike Shaw, how are you today?
Doing very well. Sad that I didn't get to make it to such an epic event, but alas, it is 2,000 miles away from me.
Oh, that's all right. You'll make it next year.
Next year is the plan.
Cool. Yeah, I'm sorry you didn't get to meet me as well.
yeah, but I will send you an autograph for sure.
Also. So, because let's face it, meeting me is just a religious experience altogether. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, it sure made me go, oh God.
Yeah. 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 I hear lots of deities are called after meeting for the first time. But seriously, it was great to meet you, and it was great to meet the lovely Tabitha as well. Also, a lot of the other bloggers that I had never met before. Great to meet y'all also, and great to see my homies in the media as well. It was much pleasantries were involved. Had my first tenderloin, even though I hear it's not the best one in town. If that was not the best one, then I cannot wait to try the best. So I'm looking forward to heading back up next year.
Do want to say welcome back to the States after a very long deployment to Mr. Sean Peachin.
Yes,
unfortunately, he returned to a dead computer, so that's why he's not with us this evening.
Yes, despite the U.S. government's best efforts, Sean is back in the country. And he was able actually to make it to the track on Sunday.
Yeah, it's good to make an eyeball with you.
Yeah, even though everybody ran off before I got to.
Everybody was down in the social media garage at about 9:30. And one of the things that I really, really enjoy about coming to the track is getting to meet all the people that I interact with online. Live and in person, and for many, this is the one chance in the year that I get to do that. Others I get to meet at Mid-Ohio or at Milwaukee or at Iowa or wherever else I'm going. But always Indy, is the biggest congregation of all of us, and it's so nice to reconnect with people and get to put some faces to names, and got to meet some new people. I got to meet some people for the first time. How about that? Some people that are new on Twitter, especially Speedway Gay. It's good to meet him for the first time and reconnect with a bunch of other people. But anyway, so yeah, you missed the show, man.
Yeah, I don't honestly know as many of the bloggers and stuff as much as I do like other media people, but I did get to see Mark Glendinig from Autosport and Jenna Fryer and Judy Kuba Dominic, who is Chevy's PR person. Always great to see Miss Judy.
She hook you Jay up Busby. With a pace car ride?
Do what?
She hook you up with a pace car ride?
No, no. I used to know the person that could do that, but she no longer is employed with IndyCar.
Oh, damn, because that would have been awesome. I love that new Stingray.
Get on that, man.
It was Liza Merkel who
Oh, you're in charge of the fan club, yeah.
Yeah. Also got to hang out with Jay Busby from Yahoo for a while. If anybody ever reads Yahoo's racing coverage, you know Jay then. And he's actually a fairly local guy to me. He's from Atlanta, so he's only 2 hours away. So we're going to try to give him
Atlanta's
the bar.
Atlanta's that close to Birmingham?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's just
see, out here, everything's further apart.
You guys have no idea. Come out west sometime, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, I used to live out west. And, yeah,
I was going to say, the size of our state is equal to the size of, like, four over there, so.
I don't know. Have you ever driven across Kansas?
Have you ever driven across Virginia?
Virginia's tiny.
If you haven't driven across Oregon, then.
You have trees. You have stuff to look at.
Only on in half of the state. We actually have a lot of high desert.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
I mean, there's trees, though. But they're a lot more sparsely populated. There's just a lot of nothing out there.
Yeah.
I'll tell you this, though. Worst drive ever is Interstate 75 south from Atlanta to Ocala, Florida, because that is a whole lot of trees. It's like a tree tunnel.
Hey, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I think I'd rather have that than the drive on Interstate 10 coming out of Palm Springs heading into Phoenix through Blythe. It is the longest, straightest, boringest stretch of roadway on the face of the planet. You're like, a bend in the road! Yay!
Yeah, you can slightly drift to the left.
My brother-in-law says Interstate 10 from San Antonio to El Paso is horrible.
I can see that being equally dreadful.
Yeah.
But, you know, the most soul-sucking, hope-dashing thing ever is the sign at the Kansas-Colorado border. Because you finally made it through the 450 miles that is Kansas Prairie, right?
Right.
Like, you see this sign, welcome to colorful Colorado. And you're like, oh, thank God. And then you're looking around and like,
where's the color?
Oh, hell, this is just more Kansas. You don't really
it's not taking
it
to the other end of the state.
Denver, and that's when the mountains start.
Right. Yeah, most of the state's in a big, giant rain shadow, right?
Yeah,
so.
And you know, it's at that point that you realize, oh, yeah, the Kansas Territory used to go to Denver. That's why the town is named Denver after the first Kansas governor.
Thought it was named after John Denver.
He named himself after the town. And then got lost in his plane.
All right, dudes, let's do this thing. On to our first topic. Here we go. Let's get this underway with some IndyCar. And, Doug, was there an event this weekend?
Oh, just a small one. I mean, we had the greatest spectacle in racing this past weekend. But
that's right. It was the Davy Allison Memorial Race at Birmingham International Raceway. Features the Southern All-Stars Series on the 5/8 mile banked oval. Wait, that's not what you're talking about,
no,
is it?
No. You know, last weekend during qualifying, it looked like it was going to be the Indy Truck Series sponsored by Hamaltro.
Yeah.
With all the rain. But yes, we had the Indianapolis 500 mile race. If you call it the Indy 500, Donald Davidson will seek you out and kick you right in the junk.
No, it is officially the Indianapolis 500 mile race.
Yes, that's how it should be called. Do not call it the Indy 500. It is not the Indy 500. It is the Indianapolis 500 mile race. I don't think the international sweepstakes portion is part of its current title, although it used to be.
God, I'd love to still include that, though. The Indianapolis 500-mile race international sweepstakes.
That'd be cool. They should bring that back.
Just like, I know, spoiler for those who don't want to wait 30 seconds to find out who the winner of the race was. But, Tony Kanaan mentioned that they believe that was one of the things that helped them to victory, was they went back to the traditional name of calling their car the Hydroxycut Special.
Nice. I hadn't caught that. They had pulled in the special.
Just like Catherine Legg's car was the Angie's List Special.
Yep. Oh, you know, there was something else about Catherine Legg's car that, while you mentioned, I'll mention it here. I was going to pull it into the Maserati Indy part. It was a partnership between Schmidt Peterson and Team Pelfrey. This was Pelfrey's first dip of the toe into the IndyCar waters. So,
well, they've been in Star Mazda. I'm sorry, Pro Mazda for years, and haven't they done a little lots as well?
No. They back in the day, you know, some of their personnel had been involved with some very successful teams. But Team Pelfrey, as it is now, came into existence only very recently.
Right.
This is their third year of operation.
Now, isn't Pelfrey who Tristan Vautier drove in Pro Mazda?
No. Who did Vautier drive for? I'm drawing a blank. I know Vautier drove for Schmidt Peterson, or then Sam Schmidt Motorsports in lights, but I'll have to pull that up.
He drove for Anderson and JDC.
Yes, back when Anderson was still involved.
Yep.
Before they dropped out to take up USF 2000 full time. And he was in 2 years. His rookie year, he fell short of the championship. His sophomore year, he won the championship, although he was very successful in his freshman year.
Yeah, he finished fifth in points in his freshman year. But that second year is about one of the most dominating I've ever seen in a Pro Mazda series, because his worst finish was fifth.
Yeah, he was Mr. Consistency, always there at the sharp end of the grid. But anyway, we drift a little bit here.
Yeah, he unfortunately would not have the best of showings at Indy, but
I was bummed about that. I really was. It was good to see the Lucas Oil name.
Yep.
That sponsored Mr. Vautier there at Indy, but he just didn't have race pace.
Fact, yeah, Tristan will wind up
16th. Whole month of May.
Yeah, of course. I mean, being a rookie at Indy and finishing 16th, you know, I'll take that.
Yes, he had it. Here's the thing: I am so used to seeing Vautier so strong and upfront in winning races, right?
Yeah.
To think that, yeah, 16th, he's a rookie. That's all right.
But, yeah, so I spent some time Sunday walking around the garage before the race. Talked to a few drivers. The first one I talked to was Connor Daly, who you could tell he was trying very hard to be optimistic, because I've got the sneaking suspicion that after his little practice crash, they pretty much probably dialed in as much downforce as possible into that car just to honestly get him through the event.
Well, and to give him some confidence as well.
Yeah.
You know, I know that Connor did a little bit in lights, but he never really did a full season in lights.
I don't think he did any oval races.
Did he?
Let's find out.
You know, I'm trying to think, and did he do the Firestone Freedom 100?
No, because he would have been in Monaco, because that's back when GP3 still raced Monaco.
Yep, right. That's right, and he had that horrific crash.
Yep.
No, the only lots races he did was he did St. Pete, Barber, and Long Beach, and then he did Trois-Rivières, and he did Baltimore.
Yep.
So his first oval.
Yep. Period.
Was in an Indy car at Indianapolis. Oy.
Driving for AJ Foyt.
Yeah.
No in your hometown.
But, you know, the fact is he did qualify, and he didn't qualify last. Yeah, he was on the last row, but he still qualified for the Indianapolis 500-mile race.
He got his face on one of those. A little nervous after that wreck in qualifying. Or not qualifying, but in practice a few days before qualifying.
He got his face on one of those sweet Last Row Society t-shirts they were selling as well.
And he got a check for 31 cents.
Yeah. I believe his tweet after that was, "Woohoo, Mom, I'm moving out."
Nice.
Lordy. Let's see, I also talked to Catherine Legg. I think I was having my own back row party that morning or something. But Lady Cat's always a pleasure to speak with, by the way. She's just always so friendly and so nice.
She's pretty honest and straight up with people. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, and I saw that the Girl Scouts were back on board with her.
Yeah. Yeah, she was a Girl Scout when she was a child, so she decided to toss him a little bone and put him on her car.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Very nice.
Also talked to a friend of the show, Justin Wilson, that morning, too.
Well, he had an amazing race, not to get ahead of ourselves, but
yeah,
he was like a ninja.
Sure was. That was the best Honda out there.
Yeah, I mean, he basically drove a perfect strategy because he held back until about, I'd say, the last 20 laps. And then he just came out of nowhere.
Brilliant drive.
Mm-hmm. He was honestly feeling good about his ride, though. He's not the type to just tell you that just to keep the owner happy, because and you know, I've read on Track Forum people talking about, you know, why hasn't like a Penske or a Ganassi or somebody picked up Justin Wilson yet? And honestly, I don't think he really wants to go to one of those teams. I think he's perfectly happy where he is.
No, wait.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't buy that. I mean, if you are a race car driver, you want to be in the fastest equipment you can possibly be in. How can you say that he's perfectly happy with Dale Coyne? I can see him being very happy with the people around him. You're comfortable with the people around him, but you can't tell me if the captain came up to him and said, "Son, I want you in my car. I want you in my car tomorrow," that he wouldn't bolt.
Well, what did Ryan Hunter-Reay tell the captain?
Okay, he's with Andretti Autosport now, and Andretti Autosport is an awesome team. I mean, look how well they did at Indianapolis.
Yep.
What I'm saying is that Dale Coyne, they did great at Indy. They've not really done – they are not a top-tier team. If a top-tier team says, hey, we want to put you in some awesome equipment, I don't know how you don't pull the trigger on that as a competitive race car driver.
Well, here's another interesting thing to think about. Who's higher in points right now, Will Power or Justin Wilson?
Well, we can get all into what's up with Will Power later on.
And do you realize how many points behind Elio Castroneves Justin Wilson is right now?
Now, that I don't.
He's 27 points behind him.
That's a race. That's a race.
Yeah.
Justin is the second highest ranked Honda behind Sato. And Wilson is going into a stretch of tracks right now that he is historically good at.
Well, he won at
at Texas last year.
Did he? No, he didn't win at Texas, did he?
Oh, yes, he did.
Oh, well, how about that? Oh, I know he won at Detroit a few years ago when he was with Newman Haas.
Yep, on the configuration that they're running this weekend, by the way.
Well, okay, you may prove me wrong, but I don't see, unless it's Andretti or Ganassi talking to you, that you turn Mr. Penske down. And even if it's Ganassi, unless you're talking about the number 9 and number 10 car, yeah.
And also take into consideration the fact that he came from Formula 1. And he's been in that ultra corporate racing style before, and he didn't like it.
Now, this is true. This is true.
Yeah.
So he may be in a very comfortable place, place where he knows he can make money, he can have some good outings, and just grind out driving a fast race car and enjoying life.
Well, and he doesn't have to have a PR agent where he is. He doesn't do 50 million public appearances every week.
Right.
He gets paid to drive. He doesn't have to bring sponsorship. He can come and race in a fairly competitive car.
That's actually huge for driving with a small team like Dale Coyne.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he gets to come and race and then go home and be with his family. So, but anyway, I digress. On to the race. Gomer was there. Alabamians making Indianapolis better since 1972.
Yes, and, you know, I wonder if this isn't the last year that we're going to hear from him.
Yeah.
His voice was shaky, I guess might be the best way to say it.
You know what was sad, though, especially if this was the last time, from the television viewing that I saw, they focused on the balloons and not him singing.
Well, no, you listen to the voice. You can't watch him sing. That is a
okay. He's got that big jaw that drops. Whatever.
Watch
sure.
him sing. Just listen to it.
But you know, I just wanted to see him one more time. I mean, I looked away when he first started, and they showed like just a glimpse, and then all they did is pan to nothing but the balloons going off into the air the whole entire time.
Yeah.
After that, so it's like they didn't even pan back to him for even just a second or anything. Nope, not at all.
Yeah. See, we at the track got the full exposure there.
And I gotta admit, it was actually kind of cool getting to see exactly how the balloons are released, because I never knew how they did it before.
Are they under a big net that they cut free?
No. They are actually in a building, like a little building with a retractable top on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like a little temporary structure.
And yeah.
It's right behind the media building. And I see everybody turn around. I'm standing on the little balcony on the edge of the media center there. And everybody outside turns around, so I turn around because I'm a follower, and I see the balloons coming up, and then I look down at this building with the top removed. So that is how it's done.
And I always find it interesting how they always end up going off in pairs. A lot of electrostatic buildup on the balloons themselves, and so you get them... you get them clinging together in these little dipoles.
Yeah.
And occasionally you'll get these strings, but usually it's just two balloons stuck together moving off. And as a physicist, I'm sitting there looking at this thinking, pondering all the electrostatics and mechanics of it all.
Anyway, race gets started. Ed leads the first few laps. And then caution
just lead the first few.
Well, I'm just getting to it.
Okay.
Then we have our first caution on lap 4.
Yeah.
When Mr. Hildebrand decides to practice his parking skills again.
It wasn't even in turn 4.
Mm-mm.
No, it wasn't even the tight turn, was it?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, it wasn't the hairpin.
It was turn 2.
Hairpin, right.
he was just practicing the Kyle O'Gara method of getting around Indianapolis, which is 4 left turns and a right.
Yeah. Well, except Kyle did it in turn 4.
Yeah. Oh. JR admitted, though, that what happened was he kind of just lost the back end of the car, and then tank slapped it, and then tank slapped it again, and then again. And
you
again.
Know, as and you just ride the wall.
As cool as the day started out, I'm really kind of surprised we didn't see more of that.
Yeah. I was honestly expecting the classic first turn pile up, but we didn't get that. So then we go green, and then we go a few more laps. Ed's still leading, and then we have an event that kind of has drawn a lot of interest, honestly, and that was the Sebastian Saavedra crash.
Yeah, that was there was some controversy there.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Bit.
Initially, in the media center, we all thought it was Justin Wilson that chopped him, looking at the cars on the monitor. But then it would come out that it was Pippa.
Yeah. Although...
And, do what?
I don't know if it was...
I don't know if you call it a chop.
Yeah, you know, because
there was a chop.
Sketchiness happening in front of her that she was reacting to.
Meh.
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 Yeah, that's a debate. I know it could probably go either way, but I'm going to give Pippa the benefit of the doubt in this case.
I'm not, because Saavedra was well inside of her going into that turn.
Okay.
Saavedra was well inside of her. She needed to either be looking in her mirrors, or her spotter needed to be communicating to her, hey, you've got somebody on your inside.
I think that is the role of a spotter right there is
exactly
to,
yeah
so pass
now,
that information.
Was it maliciously done? No, I don't think so. I think it was honestly just a racing incident. But Pippa kind of went on a little crusade after the race and
didn't help herself one bit. This gets interesting.
Yeah. and she did admit to hitting Saavedra, but she tried to place all the blame on the fact that she was behind Buddy Lazier, who was having fuel pump issues. And all right, number one, if Lazier's got fuel pump issues, he doesn't need to be at speed on the track. I think everybody can agree on that. Because fuel pump problems is not one of those, hey, just run it for a few laps and it'll go away kind of problems. But second of all, having seen the replay of it, she was significantly behind Lazier. She had plenty of room behind Lazier, and she was... If she was as concerned about what he was doing as she says she was, then she would not have been running the line that she was running. And like I said, Saavedra was well inside of her going into the turn, and she just chopped down across him. I don't think it was intentional, but just own up to it.
Yeah, I kind of thought I had heard her actually admit that she didn't know he was there, and when she saw him spinning out later, you know, as she was going down the straight, you know, in the rearview mirrors, she felt really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing either she didn't hear her spotter, or spotter didn't say anything, or something, she didn't see him coming.
Yeah.
So, like you said, racing incident.
Yeah, and you got to feel bad for Saavedra, honestly.
Sure.
And... because he was having a pretty decent run, and he had actually, part of it too was the fact that he had just cycled through on his pit stop, and he was on fresh tires. Pippa hadn't pitted yet, so she was on old tires. So, there's that. But anyway, let's see. We run a little bit more, and what was the next caution? Cannot remember.
The next caution was towards the end of the race.
Thought we had one before that.
No.
Who was it that? Well, it didn't cause a caution. There was an accident.
Oh, the Sato spin.
Yeah.
But he kept going.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, he didn't keep going. He kept it off the wall and got a restart.
Right.
And
yeah, Sato spun it on lap 57.
Yeah.
And then we went back green on 61, and the race went green from lap 61 to lap 194. When was the last time you saw that at Indy?
Never.
Yeah.
And that's why this ended up being the fastest Indianapolis 500-mile race in history.
It's amazing what happens when drivers respect each other, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
And you know what, for the most part, I saw a lot of awesome respect out there. It was great.
Yeah, I mean, it was just... It was good, clean racing. You had the pit shenanigans with... Jakes and Graham Rahal that drew an unprecedented $10,000 fine to each of them in the race from IndyCar.
Well, it was the whole blend line thing again, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it was a blend line issue because they were passing cars past the blend line.
You can't do that.
Nope.
Right.
Ask Mario Andretti.
Yeah. But yeah, so came down lap 194. Ironically enough, Graham Rahal brings out the caution. When he loses it, we have a reset of the field. Kanaan takes the lead away from, was it Marco or Munoz that he took it away from? No, it was Hunter Ray.
Mm-hmm.
It was Ryan Hunter Ray was in the lead, and then Kanaan takes away the lead from Hunter Ray, and Munoz comes with him.
Yeah, Munoz followed him around.
Then on lap 198, Dario decides that he wants to go to the J.R. Hildebrand School of Parking. And does it in turn two?
Turn one. Yeah, turn one/two, yeah.
Well, it's in the south chute.
Yeah.
I was so ticked off at Frank Keady. I'm like, are you serious? Of all
Did
the
Did you
people,
have to do it now?
Yeah.
But you know what? He was fighting that car the whole race, and he said he turned the wheel and the car just didn't turn.
Well, yeah, and you watch the replay, and you saw it go straight, and you hear him lift. He's just trying, hoping that those front tires re-grip, and they never did.
Nope.
And he just rode it all the way to the wall.
Now, the black helicopter tinfoil helmet crowd says that Dario bit it to ensure that Kanaan would win.
Well, did you hear Frank Edie's comments about that?
No.
He said, yeah, if I had intended to crash, I wouldn't have crashed so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. He said it hurt pretty good, didn't it? Yeah. That wasn't a light crash. No, that augured in pretty good there.
And although he and I may have our differences, I am not going to say that he bent it on purpose.
Right.
That's just nuts. No one does that.
Nope.
Yeah, you're going to wreck Chip's car so your buddy can win.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and you can't just say that Kanaan's the buddy of just Frank Heedy. He's a buddy of everybody.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Can we start calling the viewing mound in turn two the grassy knoll, please?
Nice.
So Dario had assistance from the grassy knoll.
Yeah.
So the place finally realizes that, number one, this race is going to end under caution. And number two, Tony Kanaan's going to win.
Yeah, Stan Jay went crazy go nuts. It was awesome.
You know, here I'm just watching it on TV, and I don't have that live audience, obviously, that you guys have. You could hear it through the TV easily, the crowd just roaring like crazy all around the damn track. It was awesome.
Yeah,
that's got to be one of the most popular wins in a long time.
I can't remember that much of an ovation for a winner.
I tell you what, Tabitha was really, really happy.
Really?
Yes, that TK is her favorite driver, and she was elated that he won.
It couldn't have been, you know, I think like he had said, you know, there are so many times that he'd been in the position of, like, Ryan Hunter-Reay, or just had something happen at the very end, and just not quite get it, or almost taken from him. And so, you know, kind of deserving. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy. He's worked hard to get there.
It was his 14th attempt.
14?
So he, do what?
Does it 14 starts?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Tony Kanaan loses the title of best driver, best active driver to never win Indy.
You know who the most impressive driver was of the month of May, though?
Carlos Munoz?
Carlos Munoz.
Yes, absolutely.
For sure. I, there's no doubt about that.
Okay, here's a little food for thought for you. The last driver who was a rookie to finish second at Indianapolis and then go on to win the race the next year, also raced for the predecessor of Andretti Autosport.
Really?
That would be Mr. Jacques Villeneuve in 1995.
Well, wow.
Let's hope that he doesn't really follow in Jacques Villeneuve's
arrogance?
Yeah, completely. I mean, yes, he won the Indianapolis 500. Okay,
oh, my
cool.
God, Jacques was
yes,
so arrogant.
He was F1 champion. Fine. But what did he do after that?
I'm going to race for Bar Honda.
Yeah. And then I'm going to go race trucks.
Hey, I saw him in his one and only truck race.
Oh, really?
Yes. It was at Talladega.
Nice.
But yeah, Tony Kanaan wins. Old timers complain because Tony Kanaan pours milk on his head instead of drinking the whole bottle like somebody did.
He drank some of it.
Hold on. Do you know why he poured it on his head?
Well, that was poured by Elio, wasn't it?
Did you guys watch the movie Senna about Ayrton Senna that was going on?
No.
That's what he did. He would always pour the champagne on top of his head. It was his signature thing. It's a Brazilian honor or homage to Ayrton
Senna.
There
you go. Well,
you guys didn't catch that, huh?
Then why did Emo drink orange juice? He's Brazilian, damn it.
Because he owns orange groves.
I'm still bitter about that decades later, and I will never forgive Emo for that.
I thought he was like lactose intolerant or some crap like that.
You can drink soy milk or almond milk or something.
Well, that stuff wasn't as popular.
Those are not options, sir.
I don't know.
Those are options, actually.
Those are not options. I saw the option list.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought those were options.
Nope. The options are whole, 2%, or skim.
Not buttermilk?
Not buttermilk.
Oh,
not
now see, I would protest that, because if I ever won the 500,
You want buttermilk?
Straight up buttermilk, sir. Old school.
And plus, Dan Weldon was also lactose intolerant.
Right.
You can spit it out.
And that was the reason Weldon poured the milk on top of his head. He like took a tiny little sip of it just for the picture and then poured the rest of it on his head because he was lactose intolerant.
Well, at any rate, you know,
that was the reason.
And that's enough for me. You know, how he celebrates is his own business.
And yep. that was the reason Dario
involves milk.
That was the reason Dario poured the milk on his head last year. It was a tribute to Dan Weldon.
Maybe that's what it was too then. But I was just watching that Art and Senna movie or documentary, and it was really cool. And that was his signature thing. He always poured the champagne on his head.
Seen that before?
I had never seen that before. That was new for me.
Oh wow! Yeah, it
was awesome.
It was. Saw it twice in the theater when it was out.
But to run down the order a little bit here, you had Tony Kanaan winning, Carlos Munoz second, Ryan Hunter Ray third, Marco Andretti fourth, Justin Wilson fifth, Elio Castroneves sixth. Yeah, the badass finishes fifth. Sixth, you had Elio Castroneves. Seventh, you had AJ Allmendinger. Eighth, Simon Pagenaud. Ninth, Charlie Kimball. And tenth, Ed Carpenter.
Yeah, it was a really nice finish by Allmendinger.
Yeah.
Yes. For a rookie for the 500.
Well,
and,
you know, it's hard calling Allmendinger a rookie, isn't it?
Well, he's never raced Indianapolis before.
He hasn't ran Indianapolis, but he's run a crap ton of open wheel cars, and he's got a long, long motorsports resume. So,
hey, if Rubens Barrichello is a rookie,
I know. It was hard calling Rubens a rookie, but you're right. He was new to Indianapolis, and Indianapolis is a unique beast.
And you're talking about, you know, a race that, you know, when you're doing road courses and whatnot, right, everything's a little more in inches. You're talking about millimeters when you're doing, you know, that high-speed oval stuff. Everything's just such a minute difference, you know, in getting that car set up just right. And that's what you have to really – you've got to communicate that as a driver to your team in a good way to get a car that'll perform at the front. And that's what I would give definitely a huge you know, hats off to Allmendinger for being able to get that set up right.
Yeah, speaking of narrow margins, just ask the Indy Lights guys.
Oh, my gosh. Best.
Yeah, let's go straight on into Indy Lights now. Freedom 100, that's the closest finish in IMS history.
That was epic. That is the greatest last lap of a race. Holy crap.
Yeah, it was the closest finish in the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
0.0026 seconds.
Yeah, not quite as good as Logan Gomez. His win at Chicagoland, 0.0005 over, I believe it was Alex Lloyd that he bested.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
But still, this was an incredible last lap. First of all, let's start on Thursday. Sage Karam comes to town, having been very strong on the ovals in Star Mazda the previous year, and in USF 2000. Reasonable with the road courses, showed that he could get it done on the street courses last year, with his win at, I believe it was Toronto. Comes in Indianapolis with one of the strongest teams in Indy Lights, Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports, and puts it on pole like a boss. The first time at Indianapolis, first time at Speedway, and bam, he's on pole. Fantastic job by Karam. Hawksworth, who really we kind of thought would be the championship leader, if not strong contender by this time, was just kind of mid-pack. His oval racing skills has not been great, but, you know, I expected him to be a little better. I don't know. I expected more out of him at Indy, I guess. I don't know what the deal was. But Sage and Chavez did a great job. I mean, of course, Munoz and Dempsey, the two veterans, as we predicted in our previous show, did extremely well, putting their cars in the at the pointy end of the grid. Race start, Karam gets a great start, defends the inside very well, and I believe it was Dempsey that came up to occupy P2 during the first couple laps, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes.
Munoz would get around him eventually and tuck in right on Sage's gearbox, and they would run like that, trying to gap the field a little bit before they started doing battle between themselves. And not too long afterwards, what was it, lap 5, I believe it was, that Kyle O'Gara tried a pretty ballsy move. And Kyle O'Gara had a good qualifying effort and was really, really racy those first few laps. But he tried to bite a little bit too much off at one time. In turn 4, he dipped down not just below the white line, but all the way down to the concrete rumble strip. And if any of you have driven IMS in iRacing or Gran Turismo 5, you know that's a danger zone right there. If you hit that concrete rumble strip, your back end will come around, and it sure did on O'Gara. And he went nose first right into the turn 4 safety barrier.
Yeah, that was a hard hit.
It was a nasty hit. But he hit it, I don't know, the entire nose was demolished, and maybe it was a good thing that he hit it so squarely and that nose was able to absorb as much of the impact as it did, because he bounced off and then just dove right into pits. He was fine and was in the USAC race at Lucas Oil Raceway the next night. But anyway, so that brought out the one and only caution. You know, and I had, as you well know, I wrote a bit about being disappointed with the driving that I'd seen so far this year in the Indy Lights series. People.
A little bit of lack of respect.
Yeah, well, losing restraint of their regression. I don't want to say lack of respect, but lack of control. And I wondered if this race was going to be like last year. We saw incident after incident with these extremely aggressive drivers on a cold track. So it was chilly that day. I think the predicted high was 66, something like that. I think it got a little warmer than they had expected, but still, it was chillier than what they were used to previously. But anyway, I kind of wondered if we wouldn't see a more incident-laden race, but big props to all involved. Everybody drove very aggressively, but also very cleanly, very smartly. It was a beautiful race to watch. Gabby Chavez and Peter Dempsey would eventually catch up Munoz and Karam. And Munoz would get around Karam about a third of the way, midway through the race, and Karam and Munoz would stay that way pretty much until the last lap. Veach would come along as a fifth there for a bit, but he brushed the wall slightly, if I remember right, and drifted back. Was not able to keep pace with the front four. There really wasn't much action up front after that, after it was those four kind of just circulating around, until the very last lap.
And really it's mostly the front three.
It was two pairs. It was
right.
Munoz and Sage, and then it was Chavez and Dempsey.
Correct.
Right? And coming across the bricks for the penultimate time, Chavez had caught up to Munoz and Karam, and Dempsey was back a little bit. And they go that way through turns 1 and 2. Then on the backstretch, Karam pulls out, gets a draft, pulls out to make his move on Chavez. And I tell you, if it had just been those two, if it had only been Munoz and Karam, then I think Karam wins this race.
Yeah.
But, so, Karam pulls out on Munoz there on the backstretch and easily starts to overtake him. Chavez pulls out on Karam and makes it three wide. And they're three wide through both turn three and turn four. Sage is sitting here sandwiched in between these other two right there. Man, that was
and
dicey.
They're all just neck and neck.
Yeah. Hugely dicey, right? And being on the outside and being able to free up the car a little bit and get it straight a little earlier, Chavez really gets the better drive off turn four than Karam or Munoz.
Yes, yeah.
However, those three running around turn three and four side by side punches a huge hole in the air.
Boy, they're just making a giant draft wall.
Yes, yes. And Dempsey is going, woo! Catch that huge draft. And he has massive exit speed off of turn four.
Not to mention he gets choice of driving line because he's not stuck in there. He can slide up.
No, he didn't have a choice.
He had to go to the outside.
That's the only.
But I'm saying is to get into that position, he had room to maneuver to get the optimal line for the outside, I should say.
Yes, yes. You know, his thought coming out of turn four is like, I might be able to get a podium for my team following Chavez through, right? And then he looks like, I've got room on the outside. And so he just keeps it. He slides in around Chavez and makes it four wide across the yard bricks, four wide across the start-finish line. And when you look at the photo finish from race control, right as they're crossing, I think it was 8 inches was the official margin.
Wow.
And you already see Dempsey with his fist in the air as he's crossing the start-finish.
It's literally the distance from the tip of the nose cone to the front of the element.
Yes. Yep. That's about all there was to it right there.
And I know we're supposed to remain fair and impartial and non-emotional and all that. But I tell you what, all of us photogs down in Victory Lane, we went crazy go nuts. We were, we were related for such a fantastic race finish. Two, a lot of us were genuinely very happy for Dempsey for getting his very first Indy Lights win. And this was Brian Bilardi's very first win as a team owner at IMS. So lots of feel-good stuff all around.
The media cafeteria went nuts, too. So
it's good to hear it wasn't just us photogs.
Yeah.
Well, that got national attention.
Yes, it did. It got airtime on the Formula One broadcast.
It got airtime there. It got airtime on the CBS Evening News that I watched. They just did a quick touch on it. You know, it was great to see that, you know, even if it was just for a few seconds showing that just that little bit with the, you know, the photo finish and how it was exciting. But, yeah, some attention well deserved.
And on Monday morning, he was on CNN.
Awesome.
It was. And it was a very good interview. I actually delayed my departure on Monday from our hotel just so I could stay long enough to see that interview. And he did a great job.
Yeah, Freedom 100 was pretty awesome. But tell me what happened with Albarico.
You know, at the one of the things that Mr. Weitzel and I really enjoy is going out to Lucas Oil Raceway Park, LARP. on Saturday night for the night before the 500. This is USAC Midgets, USF 2000, and Pro Mazda. And the USF 2000 race last year was a crash fest. You know, as you can kind of imagine, you get near 20, 30 drivers out there, young drivers, inexperienced, for many of whom this is their very first oval race. Yeah, you're going to have incidents, right? You're going to have crashes. And in fact, last year the infield looked like a Van Diemen junkyard. There are so many crashed up race cars. But this year, green the whole way. It was great. It was fantastic. I was like, really? They're going? And it wasn't because they had spread out and were all going lockstep. And it's not that this was a high bank, really big oval. One of the one and a half mile cookie cutters. This is a small 5/8 mile, reasonably flat track where the optimum line is really right up against that concrete wall all the way around. They do have safer barrier around most of it now, but you got to be right up on the wall, so it is close racing. And there was a lot of battles all throughout the field. It was a really, really fantastic race to watch. But Neil Aburico for Cape Motorsports with Wayne Taylor Racing won the pole and led flag to flag, which might make you think, well, that's kind of a boring race. But it wasn't what happened with Neil, although big props to Neil. He has had an abysmal season so far. It's been records or checkers for him. Last two races, he has been dead ass last. But this race, he puts it right there on the top step of the podium. Unfortunately, it doesn't help him out much for his championship. He's still way back in eighth, two wins and three DNFs. That's not a way to win a championship. Scott Hargrove, who has three wins so far, he did all right. He started out in second, but just slowly drifted back to fifth, kept it off the wall, kept it running. And he comes away with the points lead from the weekend, with still significant points lead, with 141 points. His nearest competitor, Wyatt Gooden, with 88, and Danilo Estrella, Ballardi Auto Racing, with 84. Garrett Grist, I'm going to talk about Mr. Grist here in a second. Garrett Grist is right behind Danilo with 83. So very, very close between those three. But Hargrove, man, he is just, he's off. So I think he was thinking, you know, the best thing for me to do is bring the car home in one piece, get a decent finish, and maintain the championship lead. There were two drivers, really, that stood out. Well, three, really. Peter Portante of Ballardi Auto Racing. If you remember when he was on the show a while ago, his forte is oval racing. He started out racing karts on ovals and then did a lot of late model stuff. And so this event at Lucas Oil really fit his skill set well. And it showed when the leaders got into lap traffic, Portante's ability to slice through that traffic just a little bit better than his competition really showed. And he worked his way up from starting fourth up to second, and he was closing on Aburico, although Aburico showed that he could slice through traffic pretty well as well. And in those closing laps, Aburico actually got through those last lappers better than Portante. But still, Portante had a fantastic finish, finishing third, his best finish of the season, and a great, great outing. I really thought he was going to finish second, and I was a little annoyed with Mr. Garrett Grist there initially, as I was watching Portante slice his way through lappers for the last time. I saw Grist make a pass on him. And my initial thought was that Grist was lap traffic. And I was thinking, kid, what are you doing? You know, show some respect for the leaders. And then I realized, oh, that was for position. He had come from fifth spot and sneakily, like a ninja, got in there to finish P2. So very, very cool driving Very sneaky, stealthy driving by Garrett Grist. Fantastic race by him, finishing second. It was an amazing race to watch. There was action all throughout the grid. Anywhere you looked on track, there were some really great battles. And so it was very, very enjoyable.
Moving on, let's see. Matty Brabb won the rain-delayed Pro Mazda race.
Yes, he did. You know, after the, you know, Mike and I sat there enjoying our beers and cigars. This is one race that I don't get creds for. Yes, it would be fun to be down there in the pits and all that, but it's a small enough track. They're from the stands. You know, they let you get right up next to the catch fence. And with a wide enough aperture, you can make the catch fence disappear. By the way, all the shots that you see on the website were shot through the catch fence. So, you know, it's like, do I want creds? No. When the race starts, I want to be up with Mr. Whitesoul smoking stogies and drinking beers. And so we were having a grand old time, but we were also sitting there watching the weather. Because there was rain, pretty substantial rain coming in, and when the Pro Mazda race was slated to get started, in fact, they were on grid, and here came the pitter patters, and we looked at the radar, and Whitesoul and I and my friend Phil, we all looked at each other and went, no, this isn't happening. So we packed it up and we were headed out, and on our way back, we heard him start up, started clicking off laps, and we're like, are you serious? So we walked up to the little turn four berm, and sure enough, they were turning laps under yellow, and like, is Barnhart in charge of this? What's going on? Because the track was shiny. They had lost the track. There was no way they were going to race on that surface. And it turned out they didn't. They shut them down, pulled them back behind the wall. And it wasn't until 11 o'clock at night that they actually got the race started. And so they get it started, and Matthew Brabham wins from pole, and he beat his arch nemesis Spencer Piggott by 0.2 of a second. So, you know, he wasn't out ahead by a mile, but you know it wasn't right there either. Anders Krohn had a podium finish, and you know we've seen Anders before in Indy Lights for a while, and recently he's gotten into the driver promotion business. Heinrich Fruseth, by the way, is who I meant to mention in USF 2000. He had a very nice 6th place finish in his very first oval race, and he was very enthusiastic about it as well. He had a good time out there. But Anders Krohn filling in for Petri Suvanto in the number 82 Team Pelfrey machine, and he'll be doing so again, I believe, in Milwaukee. But he finished 4th behind Shelby Blackstock of Andretti Autosport. Only 10 cars in the race this week. That's not surprising. Pro Mazda has a bit of a problem with car count this year. That's no reflection on Anderson's group. They have a lot of things to fix with that series. Engines number one, getting the engine budgets under control. But anyway, so the championship standings now in Pro Mazda. Matthew Brabham with his 4th straight win, 4 wins out of the 5 events so far, leading comfortably with 151 points ahead of Team Viso with Juncos Racing, Diego Ferreira with 120 points. Blackstock is adrift a bit with 104 points. The knife fight battle that we saw last year between Piggott and Brabham doesn't seem to be shaping up, as Brabham is back in, or I'm sorry, Piggott is back in fourth spot with 89 points. Well adrift, especially given his DNF at Circuit of the Americas in race two with that turn one incident. And that's all I have for Mazda Road to Indy this week.
Cool. Yeah, that Lights race was just absolutely amazing, and that's one that we'll be talking about for quite some time to come.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Let's move along now to Formula One and the Monaco Grand Parade. typical Monaco race?
Yeah, it kind of was. I mean, the real race happened in Q3, didn't it?
Yeah, it was the qualifying. The qualifying was the most exciting thing of the whole event.
Now, I will say I did enjoy the race because there's some interesting things going on. But really, the race was won qualifying as Nico Rosberg in the Mercedes sticks it on pole. Mercedes locks out the
again.
Front row. Yeah, again, except this time they can actually benefit from it because you cannot pass at Monaco, or at least it's very, very difficult to pass. Right. Jenson Button and Sergio Perez show that, and Adrian Sutil show that, no, yes, you can pass at Monaco. You just have to have balls the size of
grapefruit
balls. Yeah. to do it. Sometimes, so...
You're willing to lose some parts of your car, maybe.
Yeah, well, that's just it. You know, and this gets back at what I was talking about with the Indy Lights guys after Long Beach, is that, yes, you can be aggressive, but you have to be smart about it. You can't be unfettered in your aggression. And Perez and Big John, Romain Grosjean, they both showed some lack of control. It both making some very boneheaded moves. In fact, in the same place, Perez tried to make a move around. Who was it? Help me out. Was it Kimi? They're going into the chicane, coming out of the tunnel.
Out of the tunnel, yeah.
Yeah, and he tried to move inside of Kimi, but was nowhere near. And so Kimi had the corner, right? And Kimi moves to execute the chicane, and Perez tries to stick his nose in there where it's just no room.
Right.
And just obliterates his all the carbon fiber. There that I think it was what is end plate, right?
Yeah,
just goes up in shards. But the real destruction came when Romain Grosjean was up to his old habits. He got sat down by the Formula One for what was it? One race, two races after his
it was one race.
After his inability to keep his car from contacting others.
Yeah, it was one race.
Okay. And it was, help me out, was it after Spa?
Yeah.
Yeah, and coming out of the tunnel, again leading down to the chicane, he just fully mounts one of the Scuderia Toro Rosso cars.
Oh, man, yeah.
And
car humping.
I'm trying to remember which car it was.
That was down the escape route, yeah.
But yeah, I think it was Jean-Éric Vergne. I don't know what he was thinking. He just coming in hot, you know, is the only thing, the only way to describe it, and just rammed straight into the back of the Toro Rosso car, obliterating both cars. They're both done.
Yeah.
Right? Man, I tell you what, it's so frustrating to see what should be professional caliber racers make these just idiotic iRacing type of moves.
Everybody knows Perez is missing a few brain cells anyway.
Yeah, he's quick, but damn.
Doesn't matter if you can't keep it out of the wall.
Yeah, exactly. I think the move of the race, though, happened in the pits, and I think it was... Was it the Perez or was it the Grosjean safety car episode Anyway, during one of the safety car episodes, Hamilton ends up in pit lane. Both Nico and Hamilton are in for service. Nico gets out ahead of Sebastian Vettel and Mark Webber, but Hamilton does not. Red Bull totally punks Hamilton, catching him out in the pits, and Hamilton ends up back in fourth after having run a strong second all race long. And that's how it ends up, is Nico up front, and then Sebastian Vettel and Mark Webber for your podium. Very, very cool to see Nico win. And I say that partly because I'm a Mercedes guy, right?
Yeah.
I will be honest, I am a Mercedes fanboy. I'm super stoked to see Mercedes win the Monaco Grand Prix. But it's also equally cool to think that, you know, this is Nico's hometown. And more than just his hometown, the circuit, the streets of that circuit are the streets that he walked to school on. It's like me winning a rally on Willow Branch Road, you know?
Yeah.
it is so cool to not only win in your hometown, but win on streets that you used to walk as a kid. So, mad props to Mr. Rosberg and to the Mercedes Formula One team.
I'm not the biggest Lewis Hamilton fan, but I love me some Nico Rosberg.
Yes, I completely agree. And you know, it's interesting. They mentioned this in the broadcast that you would have thought that having Michael Schumacher on your team would have been motivation that you really need to step it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And no, not really. But put Lewis Hamilton on your team, and now all of a sudden you're like, oh, I am not going to get beat by this guy.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think having someone who's not a legend, but more of a peer, a strong peer, though, I think that is more motivational to Nico than having Schumacher.
Yeah. But it turned out all well. I was looking forward to the next race at Canada.
Mr. Shaw, we've got quite an exciting weekend in rally coming up. Tell us what's going on.
Well, yeah. Just it seems like everybody's throwing an event this weekend. So starting off with WRC is finally back after a month hiatus. They were down in Argentina and last time, and you know, obviously having to travel the cars all the way back to Europe. This time they're going to be in Greece at the Acropolis Rally, which I still try to understand how they can afford to do a rally in Greece. And not only can they afford it, but they don't charge anybody to actually go and view the rally there, which, I mean, it's great. I mean, you want spectators, right?
Well, I mean, but it's not, Greece, voted, of all places. It's not put on by the government, is it?
I think everything there is put on by the government in some way, shape, or form because, you know, most of their culture there, right, is kind of run by the government. Yeah. If you look at the percentage of people that work for the government versus private, well, at least used to be, extremely high. And that's kind of part of where their problem was. But anyway, so they're going to the Acropolis Rally, which, you know, what's interesting about that one is it is, at least now since the Safari Rally is gone, it is the roughest rally left on the calendar. It's going to be a little bit shorter this year.
The Kenyan Rally. That was
I totally agree.
Rally.
I think we need a combination of, you know, yeah, the sprints are great that they've kind of gone to, especially from maybe a spectating point of view.
Yeah.
But if you really want to see what these cars can handle, a couple of these long endurance type events, I think would be good.
Yeah. Well, and the more challenging terrain is good. And
yeah.
The variation of terrain. You know, and I've mentioned this before. One of the things I think is missing in Rally America is that variance of terrain. There's a little. I mean, we got snowdrift, right?
Right.
But then the rest is gravel roads through forests.
You know, I guess I'll differ a little bit with you on that one because, you know, at least especially like over here with the Oregon Trail Rally, every single day is very different. And
is it type of through the forest on gravel roads?
Not on day three, no.
Where
so,
is it?
So it's out in the rolling high desert plains.
On gravel roads.
On gravel roads, yes.
Okay.
Okay, so they're not doing it, you know, obviously a surface change as far as from, and actually it's more of a dirt road versus gravel, but it's a high speed type of stuff.
Yeah.
But the type of rock and gravel they deal with when they're on like Fur Mountain outside of Hood River, that is some chunky, tough, car breaking stuff. You know, when you get out into the smooth stuff, it's kind of like 100 Acre Wood. You know, you get out there in the open stuff, and it's really fast. But yeah, you're right. There's some stuff that's repetitive. I'd say that day three at Oregon Trail is very much like 100 Acre Wood, where it's more dirt-like than gravel-like, and it's high speed and open. There's not as many trees to worry about, maybe, you know, that kind of stuff. But yeah, I agree. It would be nice to have a little bit of variance. Maybe they should drop and do one in the south in the desert.
But that'd be great. I'd love to see a Southwest rally.
And I'd like to see a Southeast rally, you know? Maybe
get
something.
Muddy.
Yeah, get something out there muddy. There you go.
But anyway, so back to Greece. Sorry
yes,
for
back
the...
to Greece. So you got the, you know, obviously it's super rough out there. The stones that are in Greece are very sharp and they're big. And the cars just dig them up. It's going to be punctures are a big deal out there, so it'll be interesting to see how the tires survive. It'll be interesting to see how the cars handle high temperature under those conditions with the dust and the dirt. It's looking to be very hot. So again, you have a situation almost like Mexico where you had they're hot and high, but you have to worry about the turbos and whatnot and how they work under those high temperatures. So it'll be interesting how, you know, we've had a dominant force, obviously a VW right now, but they, you know, we'll have to see how they handle the conditions, especially, you know, dirt and dust filling up the air boxes, you know, as they're, going along in the rally in Acropolis there. So I don't know if it's straight up just hand it to VW this time. They also did a little bit of a tweak on the VWs. They made a change to the handbrake. They had a different type of handbrake before, and then at Argentina, when Andreas Mikkelsen joined the team, he had a new experimental one that they're now putting on the rest of the cars.
Wait. What, a different geometry to the mechanical handle? Is this, or is this
not
a
just the
hydraulic?
It's how the mechanics of the hydraulics work.
Okay, so it's a hydraulic handbrake.
Yes. So.
Okay. So it's a little different feel. Is it faster actuating? Is that the thing?
Yeah. They said basically it was supposed to be different feel. It was supposed to be. I think it was a little more progressive. You could really kind of. You're supposed to be able to feel it a little better. But
okay.
You know, as far as you put it in, instead, I think it was a little too snappy before. You put it on and all of a sudden you got all this extra pressure going on. And I think it was locking up for too long. You can adjust these things where it actually binds up a little bit of the front as well.
Oh, okay.
So they were actually distributing the brake pressure through that thing, and it was, I think, locking up the fronts for too long. And so
those of us in our production cars, pretending we're Colin McRae on the gravel roads,
right?
guilty. you know, we grab a handful of e-brake, and of course it's a direct cable link to only the rear rear tires, and so there's very little feel, there's no brake, and then there's a lot of brake.
Right, exactly.
So here with the hydraulic, you're saying that there's a brake balance that they can set.
There's apparently a little bit of brake balance. I was reading about that, and I was kind of confused by it a little bit, but it's either that there's a little bit of brake balance in there, or it has something where it communicates with a differential. Now, these aren't the computerized differentials, though. They got mechanical ones.
Okay.
But there might be something in there that you know, prevents maybe some of that power going to the front. But what they're specifying in there is that the fronts were locking up for when they were using the e-brake, the front tires weren't engaging quick enough versus when the back tires were locking up.
Okay.
So... yeah, again, and because there's all this added mechanics involved with this, it could be something of a concern if it, you know, this is a newer thing that they're releasing. So we'll have to see how that holds up, because it is tight and twisty on those stages out there. So it's rough, it's tough, it's twisty, and it's hot and sharp rocks. So, yeah, last year, Petter Solberg was actually doing very well and was about to, we thought he'd win it, and then he got stupid and ended up tagging a high bank and breaking his car. Meanwhile, Sebastian Loeb was going on ahead, and he actually got a puncture. Sebastian Loeb actually got a puncture, but because, you know, Solberg was out of it, he was able to stop in the middle of the stage, change the flat, and keep going, and it didn't matter. Loeb is gone this time, so it's going to be, you know, Ogier, and you've got Mads Osberg and Jari-Matti Latvala, probably your top three to watch out for. But, you know, from a reliability standpoint, you got to look at Citroën there. Mikko Hirvonen's not maybe always the fastest driver, but he's the most consistent and the safest. So this might be the one that Mikko could come out on top. I don't know. We'll have to see what happens. It'll be, of course, on World Rally Radio starting on Friday night. And then, unfortunately, because it is not even Central European time, it's one time zone back beyond that, which is like hella early for me. So if you want to follow it here in the United States, feel free to stay up all night if you want to follow the coverage. But it should be an exciting event. It always is. You never really know what's going to come out of it because, like I said, the tires and the punctures and anything can happen. So it's going to be a tough one. So next up in WRC news is there was a quick blip of Hyundai has had their first test in that new WRC i20. We don't know who the driver was yet. Yeah, exactly. So who's doing the testing? Who's doing the driving? Well, one thing we know right now is it's not Chris Meek, as much as everybody would like. He's the one that helped with Mini getting their thing going. He's actually been – oh, that would be cool. But
just throwing that out there.
Reese has been actually here in the States and you know, working with Hyundai specifically on this Pikes Peak Hill Climb car. That's a custom build.
Yeah.
So he hasn't been out there to Europe. So really, it's not sure who's out there. There's been a lot of speculation. Some people have been thinking maybe Juho Hanninen, if you remember who he is.
Ooh, that'd be an awesome driver
for them. He's good in both the gravel and on the tarmac. He's got really good experience. You know, maybe Petter Solberg flew over to Germany to give it a little bit of a test after he was done with his rallycross event that was this last weekend. I'm not sure. Nobody knows who is behind the wheel yet, but I know it's not Chris Meek because he's now with Citroën and working on the new R5 version of the DS3. So he's with the kind of Peugeot Citroën team now. So let's see here. Moving on. Next up was another note to come up with the Acropolis Rally is there was one Mini that was left. Speaking of the Minis, they kind of slowly dwindled in the WRC. Well, the last one is no longer. Michael Kuskusko, who was running the Mini, he's ditched it.
I'm sorry.
For a Fiesta.
I know it doesn't look like that, but when you say it, I just can't help but think of the pasta.
We always said that was Kosciuszko down here.
Kosciuszko?
Yeah.
Well,
there's a city in Mississippi with that name.
I like couscous.
Yeah, couscous is good stuff. So yeah, so Michael Kuskusko, he's dumping the Mini for an M-Sport Ford Fiesta. I think it's a good way to go. You know, the only Minis that did well were under Chris Meek and Danny Sordo when they were with the factory team, and they've just kind of slacked ever since. It doesn't mean the WRC Minis are completely gone. They're going to still be around with some private, where they allow some regional races to use WRC class cars. So I guess they got contracts where people are still buying them. And they're also selling regional rally cars and things like that in other versions. So it's not the end of the Mini, but it's the end of the Mini so far at the WRC level. In final WRC news, this last weekend down at Monaco, where they had the Grand Prix and all that, we had Battle of the Sebastians. Sebastian Loeb and Sebastian Ogier got to duke it out again, this time in equally specced out Porsche 911 GT3s.
Oh.
They were doing a...
what's this?
Yeah, there was a GT race that they were doing there.
GT1? An FIA GT1 race?
Let's see what they called it. The Porsche Mobile 1
Supercup. Oh,
wait,
you said a GT3, didn't you?
Yeah, they're GT3 cars, right. So it was the Porsche Mobile 1 Supercup race in Monaco. When they did their qualifying, Sebastian Ogier, who was his first time really doing this kind of a racing, he ended up actually qualifying literally like half a second ahead of Loeb. And when it all was said and done after the race, it turns out Ogier ended up finishing higher than Loeb. But that's not really a surprise because it is Monaco. Not super well. I mean, Ogier ended up finishing 13th out of 26. I mean, respectable, but, you know, not like suddenly a domination. And Loeb finished 16th, which I believe that's the three spots apart from each other was exactly what it was after qualifying. So, again, it's the Grand Parade of Monaco. So, yeah, it was nice to see them go after each other in another format, and I'd like to see more of that. It's kind of cool. Maybe we'll have a Race of Champions where it'll be Ogier versus Loeb. That would be kind of cool. Yeah. Let's see here. Then moving on, we have Rally America as the next big event coming up. They're moving over to the Susquehannock Trail Performance Rally.
And
say that 10 times real fast.
Yeah, and unfortunately, our East Coast photographer, Tom Turk, has a, I believe he said he has a wedding to do, an actual paying gig, as opposed to shooting for us. And so, unfortunately, he's going to miss the... the rally this weekend. It's a shame because he and his wife Brenda had a great time. They gave us some amazing photos.
Yeah, they got
from
some great
the rally
shots
last year.
Yeah. So STPR is in Pennsylvania. Again, yes, like you said, on the gravel forest roads out there. A little bit different there, conditions wise, I guess. First of all, it's been really wet. So it'll be interesting to see just how sloppy it might be. But they've got some, you know, the dirt roads out there really have these great kind of blind crests. If you're going to maybe say something similar as in the WRC, I'd say it's kind of like Portugal. You've got a lot of, you know, up and down kind of mm-hmm. stuff. I mean, no real mountainous areas.
Well, What's the name of those mountains over there? Appalachians.
So you're kind of the foothills, the Appalachians over
mm-hmm.
there? Yeah.
And so just like with 100 Acre, you're there in the you're not really in the foothills. You're right in the Ozarks. Just the Ozarks are older. So same type of rolly, although I think you're a little more so there at STPR, aren't you?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, it's definitely a lot more rolling hills. It seems like, you know, from the onboards that I've watched of it, you know, I've unfortunately never had a chance to attend the race. But, yeah, definitely a lot more up and down, blind crest. Got to have some really good trust in your notes.
Mm-hmm.
What'll be interesting about this event is, I guess a couple of things. First of all, unlike Oregon Trail, this is the where you just get a one-pass recce and you have to use the pre-published notes. Local guys like that because it's easier for them and they don't have the time to do a bunch of recce. But for the guys that want to go fast and to go fast, you want to do it safe. They hate it.
Yeah.
Because it's just not. Now, if this is your second or third time and it's some of the same stages, it's okay. You can then just go off your previous notes and adjust things. But it's hella difficult for a first timer that's making their own notes. And then, of course, the other couple of significant things here is that we won't have Antoine Lestage in the Rockstar WRC car. You know, as we talked about after the Oregon Trail Rally, that car is dead. They wrecked it pretty bad. Their Evo 10 that they had, set up for last year that they ran the championship in and they use in Canada is spoken for. It's being used by the Indonesian Rafat Sungkar. So, unfortunately, they don't have a car to drive, and Antoine apparently is going to go there and help out Rafat with some going along and doing some of the recce with them, and going to see about maybe helping them with the pace notes. Having two people go through it might be as good as doing a two-pass recce that way. But yeah, no rally for them. It'll be pretty much David Higgins, and hopefully Ken Block will not have his mechanical demons that he's had most of the year.
Okay, 100 Acre Wood, it wasn't mechanical. It
you're
was
right.
Stump.
You're right. 100 Acre Wood, totally his fault, but at, you know, Oregon Trail, he was just littered with issues that were not caused by him. And I actually felt bad for the guy. It was, you know, usually I can say, well, this mechanical issue, came to be because of his actions. And that was not the case this time. So, and it'd be good to put a little bit of pressure on David Higgins, because, I mean, he's just been dominant. And we also have to watch out for that guy, Rafat Sunkar. He was quick for his first time out here in the United States and doing the Oregon Trail Rally. He finished on the podium. He was third. So he might actually end up being a threat. All it takes is one of these guys, you know, maybe if it gets really slippery from a bunch of rain coming through. He's from Indonesia. They get a lot of rain over there. They get sloppy mess, right?
Right.
So
yeah, that's some muddy ass shit over there.
Exactly. And it's that slippery mud like you would have, I think, at STPR versus a gravelly type of stuff like you would have in, let's say, Wales. You know,
right.
It gets muddy there, but it's still a good gravel base.
Clay, mountain clay type of crap.
Exactly. So ice skating, right? So I think that would give Sunkar a little bit of an advantage maybe with his past experience versus Higgins and Ken Block. So it would be very interesting to see if the weather changes to some slippery stuff, how that turns out. And then also with the Rally America event, what will be interesting is because we don't have Antoine Lestage and Natalie Richard in their Rockstar Energy car, an opportunity is propped up for our friend Verena May in her little Group 2 Ford Fiesta she's got. It turns out her co-driver had this opportunity. She's in college and got this opportunity to speak at this big seminar that only comes through once a year. It's a scholarship opportunity that she – same weekend, go figure, as STPR. And yeah. It's just something that Leanne Junilla, or however you say her last name, Leanne just couldn't pass it up. You know, it's obviously something for her her career beyond rallying, and, you know, that's awesome that she was able to take it up. But here all of a sudden, last minute, Farina's going, holy crap, who am I going to use as a co-driver? Well, thankfully, stepping up is the all-time winningest co-driver in North American history, Natalie Richard, says, I'll jump in your right seat.
Nice.
Isn't that awesome?
And, that is,
you know,
great.
I wrote a little article on it on our website because co-drivers are so critical. Nothing against Juliana, who I think has been really good for them to grow together. For Verena and her, they really kind of built up a good relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, for looking at the WRC level and other drivers, it's always been that experienced co-driver that comes and sits with them for a little while that takes them to that next level.
Yeah, and you know. I think that's really what Verena needs. I know she's in an R1, but still.
Well, she's Group 2 now, so a little step up.
Okay, nice.
Yes.
But, you know, I'd still like to see her quicker, you know, and maybe this helps. Maybe this helps.
You know, and I think it will. You know, one thing that if you've ever watched the onboards that that Natalie and Lestage have posted, and you hear Natalie calling out the note, you'll hear her actually push Antoine to go a little faster. We can go faster here. She knows her driver really well and where they can push and where, you know, she's got the pace notes, so she knows where it's going to be a little more open, you know, before they do. And can give them that little bit of confidence that they need to push a little bit more and get those, you know, that extra little bit of speed to get to that next level, that extra little bit of confidence that they might not have had just doing it on their own with their previous co-driver, you know. Right. They just have so much experience and just can just read what's coming next so much better. Like I said, nothing against Leanne. I think she's awesome. And what would be cool to see is how – after this event, if Leanne meets with Natalie and Verena and you know, they discuss how it went.
Yes, and that's exactly what I was going to say, is have a debrief.
Exactly, because now you have this really experienced person that helps both of them get to that next level. So I'm really excited to see how that turns out, and I think it's just an awesome, awesome thing. So hats off to Natalie to step into that other seat, and it's going to be an exciting event for them, I'm sure. And then finally, with the Rally America event there at STPR, the people at Noble Star Rally, that team, they're such great people. They're the ones that were really good friends with Matthew Noble, who tragically died at Olympus Rally 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They are kicking off a big donation for Oklahoma tornado victims to happen during the Rally America event. So,
awesome.
Yeah, they've been through their own tragedies and had community really come and help pull them up, you know, and bring people together. And they want to use that same kind of, big family that Rally is to help the tornado victims. And I think it's awesome. Again, very noble of the Noble Star team.
That is awesome. And I've seen they've been, if you don't, you should follow them on Facebook because, as Mike said, they're awesome. And I saw they have the kookiest color scheme, and they've been painting their brake calipers and their differentials and posting all these pictures of all the goofy underparts that no one ever gets to see except when they're upside down.
Yeah,
painted all our green coat, and purple. It's like, stuff, oh, that's awesome! Way to go!
It is. No, they've actually. If you really look under the hood and take a little bit closer look at the car, if you're there, if you have the luck to be in Pennsylvania and take a look at that thing, get a close look at the car. Look around. Open the look under the hood. You're going to see some surprising pretty stuff. They do a good job on that. It's really fun. Let's see here. Another thing going on, just kind of to round things out a little bit, in the rally world, the Nameless Performance Rally, I posted an article on this, is going to be the
rally formerly known as.
Yeah, exactly. So the rally formerly known as the Olympus Rally, they were not able to use that name anymore because Rally America threatened lawsuit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Way to be a douche.
There's been some... Yeah, there's been some issues there and some very upset people in the Pacific Northwest. I guess kind of to backtrack a little bit, the Olympus Rally last year happened in September. September in the Pacific Northwest we've had a really long dry summer and there's a huge fire danger. What they ended up doing is to make the even rally run at Olympus when they wanted to do it on the schedule. They let them run super early in the morning, like at 5 a.m., and they were able to run until like 11. And then all the cars had to go to service, and they weren't allowed to run again until after 5 or 6 p.m. So they had this, 7-hour layover where they couldn't do anything because they wanted to make sure that the hottest time of the day that that they weren't driving cars out there. There were no spectators allowed on any of the stages for viewing. The only viewpoint was at a small motorsports park that they ended up doing a little super special there. So it's kind of a downer. Well, the organizers said, you know what? We'd like to do the rally more of our traditional time in the early summer or spring. So in this case, June. That was their hope, was to get back on the schedule then. Well, they had already figured out all these other rally events, and it didn't work with the schedule for Rally America. So they said, fine, we'll just do it as a regional rally. We'll drop from Rally America this year.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually going to do it under NASA rally rules.
And it's sad to say, but NASA seems to have a more robust rally and rally cross program than FCCA does at the moment.
So NASA has been really reinventing themselves, seeing the growth in rally, and what they're doing, trying to do really, is they're really focusing, instead of, okay, we know that Rally America's got a national championship and you got some of the big manufacturers there, fine, we're going to focus on grassroots. And the thing is just like any successful business, right? You find your market and you focus on that.
Right.
And they've actually been really successful with it. Actually, as an example, the last event that Noble Star did was a NASA rally. The New York tarmac, the one that's in New York.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
See, there's another surface, I think, that Rally America ought to do.
Exactly. And NASA does both surfaces, you know? I mean, think about it. There's a great video. If you do a YouTube, look up the Noble Star team and the jump that they did on tarmac in that car. I'm surprised it came out unscathed because it looked a little uncomfortable on the landing. But anyways, but yeah, that was a NASA event. So they basically said, fine, we're not going to do this under Rally America, and they needed to find some sanctioning body, though, to help out. So NASA stepped up and helped them out from this point. They couldn't call themselves Olympus Rally because they got yelled at from Rally America for non-compete, because somewhere in the fine print, of course, even though it has been the Olympus Rally since 1956, I think it was, or something like that, when they first started doing it.
Right.
That's what's in a name, you know, whatever.
Well, so, you know, you could probably leverage a legal argument. However, you get to the point of, is the juice worth the squeeze, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if... The thing is, with Rally, right now, you want growth. And by forcing such a change, you're restricting that. Yes, it's not going to be on the national event scale, but it could still be the Olympus Rally. And the thing is, especially for like regional or local people, they know it as this Olympus Rally. And if you just keep going and you have it the same time, especially the same time period, it's good too. You get that repetition and people focus on it, right? You start moving it all over the map and renaming it, it's just going to die.
Right.
So they got to be careful about that. But what's really cool is the main promoters of it, Nameless Performance, and not just to make fun of the fact that it can't be Olympus, that just happened to work out really well. There's actually a fabricator called Nameless Performance. They make yeah, I know. Their name's a little funny, but the thing is it's about their whole mindset for their marketing is about, we are not, you know, we could come up with some tagline name for our business, but our business is about our customers, and it's about we don't just design stuff ourselves. We actually make the customers be part of that design process for the parts that we make. So really, it's a little bit of everybody's involved in making these parts and whatnot. And so they make all these tuning parts for, you know, obviously for the rally cars. They're huge with rally. They're also sport tuners and whatnot. They make exhaust systems and, you know, and
really
all kinds of projects. Oh yeah. You know,
guess who's looking for a new exhaust?
Well, why don't you, look up Nameless Performance, follow them on Facebook as well, because there's actually going to be a little treat from the Nameless guys. So they're not only saving the Olympus Rally and calling it the Nameless Performance Rally and going to be running at the end of June. So it will exist. But they are actually doing something a little special. Everybody in the world has been waiting for the Toyobaru to end up being on the gravel. This will end up being, you know, as iconic as some say, as the Mark II Escort. It's a rear-wheel drive, gravel rally spec, you know, car. The BRZ/FRS, it is a well-balanced car with a Subaru engine on it. Throw a turbo on that thing, you know, get a rally set up on it, it could be just freaking phenomenal.
You know, I don't know. I've seen these cars in SCCA competition, and they're cool. Don't get me wrong. They're cool. Is it going to be an iconic rally car? You're going to have to prove it to me, because I don't think so.
Let me put it to you this way. We've been pushing for a long time, the manufacturer been pushing for making two-wheel drive relevant. They've been moving, of course, the Fiesta little R2s, right?
A lot of
championships have been moving to front-wheel drive, two-wheel drive cars. But they just aren't the spectacle that the rear-wheel drive cars are as far as drifting around those corners when it comes to rallies.
Okay. Now here it comes. We have a question about the performance versus the show. And
true.
I suspect Kevin and I will get into this when we get into IndyCar later on. But the you know, yes, it's cool to see them sliding around, and there are already some rear-wheel drive cars out in Rally America. There's that behemoth rear-wheel drive BMW, the 888, and I can't remember who the driver and co-driver are for that. But you know, it is entertaining to see them flying around, and it's entertaining to see the occasional Datsun 510.
Yes.
That doesn't mean that they're contenders.
Let me flip back a little bit, though.
8-6 is going to be a contender either. Not on the loose stuff.
Let's remember last year. Do you remember the Nissan Silvias?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so here's a little segue into that. That's actually rather important with this whole thing. The Nissan Silvias were brought over by a couple of Australians called the Summit Rally Team, and you had Will Orders with his co-driver Tony Fever, and you had Ross Allen, and I can't remember his co-driver. They brought over not only just typical Nissan Silvias, but they were 450 horsepower Nissan Silvias, okay? Those guys dominated when they were here, when the cars didn't break anyways. These cars had a lot of miles on them, granted. You know, there's a lot of stuff that that can go wrong when you're running that kind of high horsepower on obviously older equipment. So they had some mechanical issues, but any event that they didn't have a mechanical issue, they won. Where this connects up to what's going on here with the Nameless Performance Rally is that the Nameless team that are building the GT86 / FRS / BRZ, they have joined up with Will Orders and Tony Fever. They're flying them over from Australia to drive this car over at not only the Nameless Performance Rally, but after they do that event, they're going to join in Rally America.
Nice!
We are going to have an Australian Rally Championship type of, I guess, competition going on in the U.S. soil, because if you remember, we have now Brendan Reeves and Rhiannon Smythe in the Fiesta R2 front-wheel drive with Team O'Neill. That is doing the Rally America series now. They just competed last weekend at the Scouts South Australia event with the Australian Rally Championship. So basically, it's like we're seeing part of the Australian Rally Championship move over to the USA.
I'm all right with that.
I'm completely okay with that. So, you know, the Nameless Performance Rally is going to be definitely a kind of a shakedown for this car. It'll be the first time. I originally thought it was the first time that actually one of these GT86s had competed on gravel. There's been course cars made of them, and everybody's been talking about it and getting excited about it. Turns out, no, in Japan, they've already gotten a couple of them out there running. So, but anyways, I'm really excited. I'm going to get up there to the Nameless Performance Rally because I really want to see this car. It's going to kick some butt. Okay, moving on. I've been rattling too much. Remember my rant about the GRC and how the rain and they had to be rained out? Well, Ken Block ended up posting a thing on Twitter with his Instagram, whatever, talking about how it was correct that they canceled the event in Spain because they use a spec tarmac tire and they're not allowed to change.
Well, there's your problem.
Exactly. So, I mean, just like I said with my article, with my rant, you know, I agree then, fine, they should have canceled the event. But then it goes back to track design. If this is the type of tire that they're requiring, why the hell are they doing a 90% clay dirt track without any type of dirt tire that they can actually use? It is ridiculous. It is stupid. I really hope when they get here to the United States, the tracks that they use here are going to be much improved where they can use a little more tarmac. I like dirt, but if you're not going to use a dirt tire, it's useless.
Yep.
End rant. also in the GRC, found out a little bit of news that I was kind of hearing after listening to some other things on the interwebs. Pat Morrow, who was doing trying to run his own little Subaru last year, he was having a tough time to keep pace and whatnot. But when he could keep it on the road and get at a straight line speed, he could get up there, but he just didn't have the acceleration that those other cars had. Well, apparently he's got to deal with Chevrolet to bring a Chevy Sonic into the GRC.
Okay. That really
doesn't surprise.
We got a new
manufacturer coming in. But it's not a full manufacturer backing. Apparently it's, you know, obviously technical support and some support, probably some financial support. So it's not 100% backed by Chevrolet, but they're going to be there and they want to make sure that he's driving a Sonic out there and, not only for, I guess, the second half of the GRC season here in the United States only, he's not going to be going to Europe, but he's going to be end up doing half of this season and all of 2014 in that car. So, and then just real quick, the new Subaru is no longer being built in Vermont. Apparently, they didn't have it yet when they were out in Spain, but they didn't drive anyway, so it didn't matter. The car wasn't ready yet, but it is going to be built out of Friends of Saveri Isaacson, who's the veteran on the team as far as Rallycross is concerned. They're going to be doing the build of that car in Europe, where they know Rallycross better. So that's it for GRC news. And I just wanted to touch on Pikes Peak coming up. I kind of mentioned it in our opener. Boy, is it going to be awesome. Yeah, it's not until the end of June, but it is going to be epic. We've got.
Do you really think Reese has enough to take it to Loeb?
I do, because of experience, right? How often do people win? You've got to remember every turn, right? This is not a co-driver speaking out pace notes.
It's a known track. I mean, it's not like they're getting pace notes the day before the race.
No, but, you know, he's got so many.
You could go and drive it right now.
Sure, you could. Well, obviously, you know, staying on your side of the road.
Well, yeah, sort of.
But
yeah, spotters.
Right. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, Loeb hasn't been over here yet.
Fans out there know what I mean.
But if you go on to YouTube, look up the, you know, Sebastian Loeb's or the Peugeot Pikes Peak car that they've got coming. And then also look up Reese Millen and the Hyundai Pikes Peak. He's got a new car. It's not the Hyundai Genesis anymore. It's a custom-built Pikes Peak open-class car. You can already see this YouTube wars of videos that they're both doing to promote the challenge coming up, and it's going to be freaking epic.
So, you know, I like Reese, but I gotta give the edge to Loeb. I really do. You know, when you talk about experience, Reese is a drifter. And yes, he did well last year. Yeah, I know. but Loeb is the winningest.
He's the tarmac master.
Yeah, and he is a rally god. He really is. You know, I have to give it to Loeb. I just have to.
It'll be interesting to see. It's a very interesting. It'll be interesting about the cars too, because what makes it challenging at Pikes Peak is you're starting at 4,000 feet and climbing to like 9,800 feet. So it isn't. So you're really high, and the way you these cars will say that they're 950 horsepower or something crazy like that, but they won't be at that altitude. At sea level, yes. So it'll be interesting to see how they really end up performing once they're up at altitude and going up against each other. I'm really excited. I think there's a lot to happen there.
Yeah.
And that pretty much brings us to our end of the show here. I actually have a couple of quick IndyCar notes I need to hit.
Yeah.
First of all, we forgot to mention that in Detroit, Mike Conway will be driving the number 18 with Dale Coyne instead of Ana Beatriz.
Both races,
yeah. Also,
is our first doubleheader, right?
Yes, it is. Standing starts on Sunday.
Awesome.
Also, I need to mention that it looks like J.R. Hildebrand is out at Panther, and Oriol Servia will be replacing him.
Is that official?
That's not official, but Kurt Cavan is feeling well enough about it to report it.
Hey, that's official enough for me.
Yeah. Yeah, because Kurt doesn't report anything unless he is pretty dang certain.
Yeah, if he's confident enough to pull the trigger on it, then bank it.
Yeah. So there's a couple of IndyCar tidbits for you there to end the night. So you got anything else, Doug?
No. Yeah, I'll watch. I should say I'll catch the highlights of Detroit because this weekend I will not be watching racing.
You will be actually racing, right?
I'll be actually racing.
Yeah.
We have the Military Appreciation Weekend at Heartland Park Topeka this weekend. And so I've invited my buddy Phil out to co-drive my Focus. And so we'll be out trying to dodge cones at Heartland Park Topeka this weekend, having a grand old time of it.
Excellent.
And I would also like to promote, and I will do this again next week, on June 8th at Metropolitan Community College Performance Driving Center. We are having our second solo school of the season. Welcome to all, not just novices, but anyone who wants a little refresher, a little extra tuning, maybe just a little extra seat time. Sign up for the school, and $70, and that includes the solo event the next day on the 9th. And we've got some really outstanding drivers here in the club, and they will sit one-on-one with you. And you'll get about three events worth of seat time at the school with instruction. It's, you know, for $35 for the school, well, $70 for the school and the event the next day. Man, I don't know where you're going to get more driving instruction for the for that kind of money.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So make sure to sign up. There's 15 seats available. Make sure one of them's yours. Mr. Shaw, any leftover rounds in the chamber?
You know, the only thing that I've got to say would be is, like I said, I really hope good luck for Ken Block, which I kind of strangely saying. But it'd be nice to see someone take it to David Higgins, who's had just such a dominant season with Rally America. So that's probably the event I'm most excited about for the weekend.
Excellent. Well, I don't have anything else, so I guess we'll close this one out. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the podcast, and have a great night.